World Health Organization warns the situation in Gaza is close to being the darkest in human history as Israel presses ahead with its genocide in Gaza. Hamas condemns the U.S. president for repeating Israel's accusations against the Palestinian resistance movement, saying that it proves of Biden's moral decline. And Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. and Israel will never be able to eliminate Hamas and resistance in Gaza and cannot make decisions for Palestinians. Hello everyone and a very warm welcome to World News. And Israel continues pressing ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Regime's war machine has killed more than 16,000 Palestinians since October the 7th, mostly women and children. Israel's extended its operations to southern and central Gaza now. Nearly 50 people were killed in air raids in the central city of Deir al-Balah. At least 25 people were also killed in a strike that hit a school that was sheltering displaced Palestinians in Khan Yunis. Hospitals have not been spared. Either regime's military vehicles destroyed the main electricity generator for Kamal Adwan Hospital. Palestinian sources say Israel also is preventing ambulances from reaching the injured. The Gaza Health Ministry says over 400,000 people in northern Gaza have no access to medical services. The WHO raised the alarm about the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza.
And I think we are close by it. It's humanity's darkest hour, and this is, has been the message I think from WHO, the UN in general. This bombings and I would say and senseless loss of life must stop now. I mean, we need a sustained ceasefire. Maybe I want to say something about maybe our biggest concern, and that is the vulnerability. The vulnerability of and looking at for a health perspective, the vulnerability of the health infrastructure. So the health infrastructure in Gaza, the health system is crippled.
Pieper Korn said the situation in Gaza is deteriorating by the hour. WHO supplies have also moved from Khan Yunis, been moved, that is, from Khan Yunis warehouse to a smaller facility in Rafah. That was because of an Israeli threat. And that is according to the Director General of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, said transfer has led to the postponement of planned medical deliveries to Doctors Without Borders and UNRWA health facilities. And here are comments made earlier by spokesman of Gaza's health ministry describing the situation at hospitals in southern Gaza.
The wounded and patients are on the floor. There's no life-saving health service in the hospitals of southern Gaza Strip. Hence, hospitals in Gaza have totally collapsed. They cannot deal with the quantity and qualities of injuries that arrive at the hospitals. It is difficult for the ambulances to reach the injured in the targeted areas. The Israeli occupation targets ambulances that move in the southern areas of Gaza Strip, and it prevents them from reaching the targeted places. The health situation in the Gaza Strip's hospital is catastrophic. There's no health service in northern Gaza because of the huge pressure of the injured in the hospitals that are left, which are small hospitals, that in turn became targets since yesterday up until now. The Israeli occupation wants to put northern Gaza's hospital out of order in order to force citizens to flee to the south of the Gaza Strip.
Hamas has taken the U.S. president to task for waging a smear campaign against the Palestinian resistance movement following the surprise Operation Al-Aqsa flood against Israel on the 7th of October. The resistance movement condemned President Joe Biden for echoing Israel's allegations of sexual violence and rape by Hamas fighters. Hamas said Biden's behavior proves his moral decline since he has just repeated Israel's false claims about resistance fighters. Hamas says such blatant lies are aimed at covering up the, quote, Nazi Israeli regime's war crimes being committed against Palestinians using American weapons. The movement also called on the international media to prove the falsity of the new accusations leveled by the U.S. and Israel, as was the case with the previous claims about Hamas beheading children or using hospitals as command centers. International outcry continues to grow over Israel's relentless atrocities against the women and children of Gaza. The Emir of Qatar says the Israeli regime is violating all humanitarian values.
All religious, ethical, and humanitarian values have been violated in occupied Palestine through crimes the occupation forces are committing against humanity.
Sheikh Tamim slammed the international inaction in the face of Israeli crimes as shameful. He added Israel is committing genocide in Gaza and called for a lasting ceasefire. Sheikh Tamim was speaking at a meeting of a union of six Arab countries in the Persian Gulf known as the GCC. Elsewhere in the meeting, the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says that Israel is committing crimes against humanity and wants the regime in Tel Aviv to be brought to justice.
The Netanyahu administration is endangering the security and future of our entire region in order to extend its political life. The loss of life of 17,000 Palestinians, mostly children and women, is a war crime and a crime against humanity. Israel should not get away with these crimes.
Meanwhile, UN Chief Antonio Guterres has described the humanitarian situation in Gaza as catastrophic. Jordan and Iraq have also called for the international community to stop Israel's brutality. The Norwegian Refugee Council, which protects the rights of the displaced, says the bombardment of Gaza ranks amongst the worst assaults on any civilian population in the modern era.
This is a letter by The Elders, a group of independent global leaders working for peace, justice, human rights, and a sustainable planet. The group was founded by Nelson Mandela in 2007, which includes the former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Calling on Israel to stop the murder of Palestinians is a good thing, but how to go about that to prevent that from happening is another. Watching a genocide happen, for it to stop, and then for it to resume with full force is itself unprecedented in history. As soon as the pause ended, the Israeli killing machine continued with its carnage, and within the span of a little over 24 hours, it murdered over 700 Palestinians. The rate at which Palestinians were being murdered, however, has come into focus. How could Israel kill so many Palestinians? How did it know what to target? That answer came in what is now known as the Gospel. It has been revealed that Israel uses an AI, artificial intelligence program, named Gospel, to select bombing targets in Gaza.
I think a good year to look at, to understand its beginning with relation to Gaza, is 2019, when the chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi, introduced this new division in the military called the Targets Division. And its idea was to bring together hundreds of soldiers and basically start to develop these AI algorithms and automated software to accelerate the target creation for strikes with life and death consequences in Gaza.
This was revealed by the head for military affairs, Aviv Kochavi, an interview before the war. He said the Gospel was a machine that produces vast amounts of data more effectively than any human and translates it into targets for attack. He added, to put that into perspective, in the past we would produce 50 targets in Gaza per year. Now this machine produces 100 targets in a single day, with 50% of them being attacked. This may explain why Israel has bragged about round-the-clock airstrikes and how it targeted, for example, 600 Hamas targets in a span of 24 hours. Even so, the end result is a complete failure. The data-driven factory has resulted in massive Palestinian casualties.
There have been many conflicting statements and posturing by Israel and the U.S. when it comes to the end game of this war. While Israel has mulled the idea of forcibly displacing Palestinians down into Egypt or Jordan, U.S. has said that that will never happen. And while the U.S. president has said that a recalibrated Palestinian authority must rule the Gaza Strip after the war, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has come out just as recent as today, telling Washington there will be no Palestinian rule or Palestinian Authority rule in Gaza once the war concludes.
We're pursuing Hamas wherever Hamas is hiding, in the north and in the south.
The Israeli military spokesperson's statements made one thing clear. Israel's warning for Palestinians to evacuate to the south was an empty promise, since Palestinians were being targeted in the south also. Israel is trying to put on a show of caring for lives with the repeated but false issuance of warnings, this time in the form of grid maps. Israel has started using this new grid system, which breaks Gaza down into more than 600 blocks and can be accessed through a QR code on leaflets and social media posts. But how are Palestinians, who don't have anything except the clothes on their back, going to retrieve and follow these maps? What is becoming clearer by the day is that Israel crammed the Palestinians in the southern part of the Gaza Strip with the intention to push them into Egypt. Egypt thinks that is the case, that Israel is attempting to push Gaza's Palestinian population into the Sinai. Yet the U.S. has said that is definitely not the intention. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has said, under no circumstances will the U.S. permit the forced relocation of Palestinians from Gaza or the West Bank, the besiegement of Gaza, or the redrawing of the borders of Gaza. Even Israel has been quiet on this issue, issued a statement saying that it does not have the intention to forcibly move or remove Palestinians. In the meantime, the Israeli army has divided the Gaza Strip into sections. This is while the fake border with the occupied territories was being pushed further into the Gaza Strip, decreasing the landmass of Gaza. This may indicate Israel's desire for creating the so-called buffer zone, which may then have international forces there. Just as Israel is cornering innocent Palestinians in the southern Gaza Strip, the U.S. is cornering itself with its all-out support for Israel, which may ultimately pose a challenge to Biden's presidential aspirations. But then again, what's more important, Palestinian lives in the hundreds of thousands or the political life of Joe Biden?
Hundreds of Jordanians have gathered outside the U.S. Embassy in Amman to vent anger at Washington's complicity in the relentless atrocities in Gaza.
The truth is that what transpires in Gaza is not a war between Israel and Hamas. Instead, it constitutes an all-out assault by an occupying regime armed to the teeth, backed politically, militarily, and in terms of weaponry, intelligence, operations, and propaganda by the United States against the Palestinian nation, whose land is occupied, and who have endured attacks, killings, assassinations, arrests, torture, siege, and bombings by this occupying regime for 75 years.
Protesters chanted slogans and held banners against the U.S. Similar demonstrations have frequently been held since early October in support of Gazans. The Tuesday protests, however, took place a few days after the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken returned from Israel, his third trip to West Asia since the 7th of October. The U.S., Israel's greatest benefactor, provides the regime with billions of dollars worth of annual military assistance. That unconditional support has grown in scale in recent weeks as the regime has intensified its brutal onslaught on Gaza. Israel's supporters, especially the U.S., have continued to justify the regime's savagery in Gaza. Some of them describe it as a war between Israel and Hamas. Iran, though, has denounced this narrative, labeling the conflict, quote, a humanitarian tragedy.
The truth is that what transpires in Gaza is not a war between Israel and Hamas. Instead, it constitutes an all-out assault by an occupying regime armed to the teeth, backed politically, militarily, and in terms of weaponry, intelligence, operations, and propaganda by the United States against the Palestinian nation, whose land is occupied, and who have endured attacks, killings, assassinations, arrests, torture, siege, and bombings by this occupying regime for 75 years.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the Zionist American Coalition has unleashed a propaganda bombing against Gaza. Kennedy said this sort of propaganda is as relentless as a barrage of missiles pouring down on Palestinian civilians in the besieged enclave. Iran's foreign minister says the U.S. and Israel will never be able to eliminate Palestinian resistance from Gaza.
The Americans must quit making strategic mistakes. Neither the U.S. nor Israel is capable of eliminating Hamas and resistance. They cannot decide on behalf of the people of Palestine and Gaza. Leave Palestine for the Palestinians and avoid another huge regional defeat for the U.S. ahead of the presidential election there.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the war on Gaza will have no outcome for Washington or Tel Aviv. He said resistance is able to withstand Israeli attacks and continue their retaliatory operations. The Iranian minister said evidence shows Israel has been after the forced displacement of the people of Gaza to the Sinai Peninsula. Amir Abdullahian was speaking in Russia, where he was attending the 12th annual summit of foreign ministers of five Caspian Sea littoral states. Meanwhile, Iran has slammed a unilateral coercive measures imposed on countries, saying they have negative consequences for maritime navigation and security.
The illegal unilateral coercive measures have jeopardized efforts to combat environmental problems, including by impeding access to new technologies, know-how, and adequate financial resources. These unlawful actions have far-reaching and negative consequences for maritime navigation, impacting trade, safety, security, and international relations.
Ershadi said that confronting such illegal measures requires effective implementation of international law. She said military presence of extra-regional countries in the Persian Gulf threatens the security of coastal states and free navigation in the international waterway. The Iranian diplomat added the foreign military presence also leads to maritime pollution and depletion of regional marine resources. Ershadi also reiterated Iran's commitment to a marine order based on international law of the seas. She said Iran is opposed to escalation of conflicts among the littoral states of the Persian Gulf. The Iranian diplomat said such tensions jeopardize regional development and prosperity. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Irish professor Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Today, we are going to sum up the views of those Western researchers whose views we have presented to you on the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please. The Islamic Revolution has been focused by many thinkers and researchers across the world due to its unique nature and the unmatched impact it has had on global developments ever since its victory in 1979. Michel Foucault was one of the outstanding thinkers whose views we presented to you briefly on the Islamic Revolution and its peerless leader, Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Revolution emerged in the age when religion had been isolated, especially in the social aspects of life. French thinkers, Foucault, did not follow his contemporaries to call religion as the opium of masses. In fact, this was the famous belief of the German thinker, Karl Marx. Foucault had indeed believed in another statement of Marx, where he had said, "Religion is the spirit of a spiritless world." Foucault considered religion as a generating, converging, and creative force which puts forward a novel kind of discourse and method of living. The French researcher maintained that the Iranian Shah had omitted ordinary, unofficial powers like opposing political parties and groups, neglecting that this would reinforce a dispersed network of power among people. He calls the Shah and the army as the explicit symbol of power and violence against people's congregated and accumulated power. He opines that religion, spirituality, and congregated willpower, coupled with Imam Khomeini's highly influential and charismatic personality, were the core of the Islamic Revolution. In short, Michel Foucault is of the opinion that Iran's Islamic Revolution demonstrated the glory of faith and willpower and the lofty Islamic culture to the world. Ahmed Algar was another thinker who spent years to research on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. This British thinker maintained that the Islamic Revolution would have never gained victory had there not been Imam Khomeini to lead the people. He, like Michel Foucault, believed that no other group of the so-called rightist or leftist parties was able to unite people around a single cause. He says that in the horizon of Iran, there was no other person to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his invitation. Algar considers Imam Khomeini's courage very important in making hard decisions. He refers to Imam's firm link with religious establishments and his deep attention to Islamic wisdom and irfan, which is cognizance. The British thinker gives high role to Imam Khomeini's spirituality in his confrontation with enemies. Nikki Keddy was another Iranologue and researcher of West Asian studies from the University of California. She called the Islamic Revolution as Iran's cultural reaction to the unwanted presence of the American imperialism in the country. The American University lecturer says that the high level of dependence on the U.S. during the Shah regime caused innumerable economic calamities in Iran. This led to uniting of people by Imam Khomeini to stage a great revolution to cut off the hands of foreign occupiers in various domains of the country. Keddie highlights two characteristics as the main parts of Imam Khomeini's personality, namely being uncompromising and resolute. Armenian-American University lecturer Yervand Abrahamian is another thinker who has studied on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. In his opinion, although the Shah had made economic and social developments, he had forgotten to form a matching political structure. Like most thinkers, he too believes that Imam Khomeini played the main role in bringing the hearts of people together and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. For sure, his unprecedented popularity among people from all walks of life was very effective in this regard. Abrahamian, however, pays attention to Imam Khomeini's simple way of life as another feature of his disposition, alongside his being uncompromising against the illegal and illegitimate ruler. The American University lecturer says that the Imam ably caused potential powers among people to converge on a single course and mobilize them in the struggles to topple the oppressive and dependent regime. In continuation of reviewing the opinions of Western thinkers of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, we talked about the views of John Foran and Fred Holliday. John Foran, from the University of California in Santa Barbara, focuses on the despotism of the Pahlavi regime and the dominance of foreign powers, particularly the U.S., on Iran, as the two main causes of the Islamic Revolution. Reviewing the two revolutions of constitutionalist movements and oil nationalization during the past 1.5 centuries, he stresses that both movements failed due to the defeat of the people's resistance. He then goes on to say that Imam Khomeini's leadership was very effective and determining in the formation and victory of the Islamic Revolution. Irish University lecturer Fred Holliday also said in a speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution is the most modern revolution in the history of mankind, while it was a non-violent development. Like others too, he too is of the opinion that Imam Khomeini played a key role in the formation and triumph of the Islamic Revolution. He then continues that the transition of power after the Imam's passing away was a very great achievement in the history of the revolution and an unprecedented event in the history of Iran and the regional nations. He correctly says that the peaceful transition of power after the Imam's demise and the people's reaction to this was a prominent sign of his legitimacy and that of the Islamic Republic system. Holliday points to the ideological basis of the Islamic Revolution, such as independence seeking, convergence of Islam and democracy, strengthening of Iranian identity, and so on, and considers Imam Khomeini's simple way of life and his honesty as the most important factors for his unmatched popularity among world leaders. A noteworthy point in Fred Holliday's views is that he seriously distinguishes between the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini and the extremist and savage views of Taliban and Al-Qaeda Salafists. He maintained that Iran enjoys a very rich and bright history and owns a very lofty cultural, economic, political, and scientific status among the regional nations.
food for thought.
Hello, everyone. Let us reflect on what the Holy Prophet's divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, has said about prosperity in life and salvation in afterlife. Charity is an effective cure, and the actions of people in their present life will be before their eyes in their next life.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, reliance on Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Trust and reliance in Allah is an admission of our shortcomings and a reliance on Him for success. It is a duty of a faithful to have trust in Allah and to believe that their success depends on Allah's will. Without Allah's will, there is no concept of success in Islam. So if you minus Allah from your affairs, your everyday daily life affairs, this means you can never achieve that success, the divine success, ever. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran says, Allah, there is no God but He. And upon Allah, then let the believers rely. See, Allah is commanding the believers here to rely only on Him. Now, you may ask that, you know, okay, fine, there is a reliance on Allah and also a reliance on other than Allah, right? So, you know, what's the difference? Where does the line draw? Our belief says, the Islamic belief, the Shia belief says, reliance on other than Allah can potentially amount to shirk, which is polytheism. But if we look at our daily lives, we rely on so many sources other than Allah, right? So for instance, a baby depends on and relies on his mother. A student relies on his teacher. A friend relies on a friend. How can we reconcile this belief of ours with the reality on the ground? Right now, we seem to be in a quagmire, right? If we have to as a believer, rely on Allah only. So where do we take all these other reliances? Let's try to answer that question right after the break. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the reliance on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So how do we reconcile our belief that seemingly differs from our everyday life activities, right? And what is that belief? That belief is that we rely only on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and nobody else. But in everyday life, we see that we rely on so many people around us, right? Do we rely only on Allah? You know, ask yourself this question. Do we not take help and assistance from other than Allah? Again, a question that we all should ask ourselves. Well, the answer is quite simple, but profound. As Muslims, our reliance must only be on Allah, and any other reliance that we have in our lives has to be looked at and perceived as reliance on the means that Allah has created for this purpose. Allah is the only one who gives any ability to any being or any creature. Allah is the ultimate source of any power and ability. Others have been granted the ability by Allah. So as long as the acknowledgement of Allah being the ultimate source is there, we are not committing shirk in any form. But if someone considers any other source of power to be independent of Allah, they have committed shirk. Allah is the only ultimate source of power, strength, and ability to do anything. Then further, He has delegated certain abilities to other creatures in this world. And that's totally fine to rely on those creatures as long as we realize that their potential ability comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
The densely populated Adarj neighborhood lies in the heart of Gaza City. Residents of that neighborhood still keep a copy from a local newspaper that had the front page news of the sad night of July 23, 2002. Back then, the U.S. made F-16 warjets of the Israeli occupation army turned the calm of the neighborhood into horror and fear.
It was a quiet, peaceful, and calm night, despite the extreme heat. I was not sure we heard or not. Personally, I heard nothing. I rather felt a pressure inside me, or something pressing me inside out. I could feel nothing. It was like something carried me a meter high from the ground for a while, then dropped me on the ground. The power was cut. Then I felt the horrors of the day of resurrection.
An F-16 warjet dropped a one-ton bomb on the neighborhood to assassinate Salah Shadeh, the leader of the military wing of the Islamic Resistance Movement Hamas, resulting in 17 fatalities, including 11 children and 3 women, while 176 people were injured and tens of houses were damaged.
The Al-Daraj neighborhood crime is an example to be studied of a war crime against civilians, not against Sheikh Salah Shahada himself. They are willing to kill. They made a decision by different political and security levels to target a family amid civilians while they were fully aware of the dire consequences of this. I expected that something happened to us. We moved from one area to another. Our house, street, and neighborhood did not look like they used to be anymore. There were rubble, destruction, and people crying for help, while people from other areas rushing to help them. I heard stories from people saying a plane fell behind Al-Ashi carpentry next to our house. Not our family sustained the greatest loss, where they lost 7 family members.
A decade after the massacre, Matar family members who lost a lot abstain from talking about their catastrophe.
The family was overwhelmed due to that. If you say anything about what happened, they would recall the sadness. I will tell you about Ra'id, who is the elder and who lost 3 kids, 2 boys and 1 girl, as well as his wife. His shock was deep. Until now, he has nervous collapse every time we bring up the subject.
Ahmad Matar was 12 at the time of the massacre. He broke the silence to talk about the inhumane crime that happened to his family.
My sister and sister-in-law with her 3 kids died, as well my 2-month-old niece. After 3 weeks, my grandmother died. The bodies of my nephews were found 2 days after the incident. They found the bed where my nephew slept turned upside down with loads of rubble on it. A committee came from hospital and checked the matter, taking them all to the hospital, then right away to the graveyards. It's a typical war crime, and those who committed it, not only at the security or military level, but also at the political level, must be brought to justice. Those who gave them the political endorsement and made the decision for such action are still free. We didn't see them standing in trial. Whenever there is any breakthrough in a given country to file a complaint or prosecute one of those, the state changes the law of the country to protect the Israeli criminal.
The Israeli occupation apparently relied on the fact that none in the world is going to hold them accountable for their vicious crimes. That made them further torture and kill Palestinians ever since the eruption of the Al-Aqsa Intifada in 2000. It is not likely for Palestinians that a day would pass without a massacre. On May 5th, 2003, the Israeli occupation invaded the area of Az-Zaytun neighborhood, killing 17 people, injuring dozens more, and destroying many houses. The outstanding event was burying 3 residents alive.
My son Ihab and his colleagues, Amir and Walid Azam, were injured during the first night. The ambulance crew tried to rescue them, but they couldn't because the snipers were on the roofs in the area. They tried to throw ropes to them and tried to turn around. My son Ihab asked for water. The Ndola family, may Allah reward them, threw 3 bottles to him, but none of them reached. Between 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning, the Israeli bulldozer buried them alive.
9 years after Ihab's death and the birth of Ihab Jr., baby Ihab only knew his father from photos, but he knows who killed him.
She was 5 months pregnant when her husband was killed from the Israeli occupation army. She gave birth. We looked after the child and raised him. He went to kindergarten for 2 years, then to school. He's smart and he's already joining the third grade.
The baby, who was still a fetus, was deprived from his father, but was not deprived from the type of life children of Rafah experience along the borderline with Egypt. Rafah City and its suburbs are a living testimony of tens of massacres that targeted the city, especially Tell el-Sultan massacre during the Israeli incursion on the eve of May 12, 2004.
I live in Tell el-Sultan. I was in the yard when I started receiving calls with news about Tell el-Sultan. People were saying that the area was closed by the Israeli occupation army. People were saying they are leaving Tell el-Sultan. Then they were saying that Israeli occupation army is watching people closely. Anyone who was going to the roof was shot. For example, a girl was trying to feed the pigeons, then was shot down. Our neighbor, who was a well-known sport person, was shot by a sniper when he was looking from the window.
They could see he was an incompetent. He was sitting at home and doing nothing. He wanted to get ready for midday prayer. I asked him to hide with us under the stairs. His brother Ibrahim came down, telling us he was injured.
One of the harshest moments Umm Ibrahim has experienced was the sight of her son laying dead on the ground while she couldn't do anything but cry.
Can you imagine how would we laid and covered him by blanket? We still crying till before sunset. When the ambulance came from Gaza, they were told someone was shot dead and that his parents are about to lose their minds. Then the ambulance crew came on foot with our neighbor to carry him. And I carried him on my chest, laying him at our neighbor's back. They took him while we were asking Allah to bless him the paradise.
Ibrahim's body was buried while his family stayed alive, and people of the neighborhood remained hungry and wounded, waiting for a helping hand to be extended to them. The children of Rafah answered their call and took to the street to break the siege.
When the demonstration proceeded from Zahrab roundabout towards Tell el-Sultan to break the siege on them, the tanks targeted the demonstration at Zahrab roundabout. They first hit the building, destroying the doors, as you could see. Those are the signs of the shrapnels that scattered all over people, as well as the doors' shrapnels. The second and third shells targeted the very same place in the building, with 3 or 4 seconds interval between each. Missiles were coming from tanks and planes, hitting the walls and doors to make shrapnels and hit people. People closed all small alleys and streets. People were falling on the ground due to injuries, and people were carrying other bleeding people. The area became horrible. People didn't know where to take other injured people. The Israeli occupation army's checkpoint was there in front of you, and the demonstrators were blocking all the way back to Rafah.
The children marched, couldn't make it to Tell el-Sultan, where the Israeli tanks and war jets intercepted their attempt, targeting them and killing 9 organizers and leaving 45 others wounded, raising the death toll of Tal al-Sultan massacre to 60, most of them children. This huge number of martyrs surpassed the capacity of Rafah Hospital morgue. Dead bodies needed to be kept refrigerated till proper burial.
We thought we need to find a vegetable refrigerator. We started to put martyrs there. The death toll reached approximately 65 people. After the siege was lifted, people started coming to identify the bodies of their relatives. All martyrs were brought to the playground with their families who came from Tal al-Sultan. Then the biggest funeral ever started with the bodies of 65 martyrs taken to the burial as a result of the siege and the demonstration.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
While Western societies were quick to believe Israeli propaganda about October 7th, much of the non-Western world remains skeptical due to the Zionist regime's staggering record of lies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, since 1967, the Zionist regime has held the entire Palestinian people who live in the West Bank, Gaza, and East al-Quds hostage. Since 2006, it incarcerated those in Gaza in the largest open-air prison in the world and is now slaughtering them unless they agree to self-expel. If anything, it is the Americans, the Brits, and the Europeans who should order their own nationals as illegal colonial settlers in the West Bank and East al-Quds to vacate the occupied territories and repatriate to their mother countries. In 2017, it was estimated that about 65,000 U.S. citizens were colonial settlers in the West Bank alone, 15% of the total settler population at the time, not counting its al-Quds. They constitute almost a third of 200,000 American settlers living in the occupied territories, and many among them consider themselves liberal and left-wing and professionals. The fact that at least 1 million Israeli Jews hold European and U.S. nationalities should impel the U.S. and European countries to invite them back to their home countries to ensure their safety and so that they can make room for the indigenous Palestinians in Gaza, whom their colonization had displaced in the first place, to return to their original homes and lands in accordance with international law and UN resolutions. No Arab leader, let alone the Palestinian Authority, would dare make such demands, whether in public or private, to the Americans and Europeans. Yet these reasonable demands, which are in line with international legitimacy, could contribute to ending Israel's belligerent insistence on maintaining Jewish supremacy and settler colonialization in the lands of Palestinians. The scale of Israel's savagery since October 7th has superseded its previous barbaric wars. The Zionist onslaught in 1947 to 1948 to conquer Palestine killed upwards of 13,000 Palestinians, more than 11,000 of whom were civilians, not counting the 3,700 Arab troops and irregular who were killed. The Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982 killed upward of 18,000 Palestinians and Lebanese civilians. The Zionist regime's ongoing genocidal war on Gaza has killed so far upwards of 20,000 Palestinian civilians, more than 15,000 confirmed dead, including 6,150 children and 4,000 women, and more than 7,000 missing under the rubble, far surpassing its previous carnage. The Israeli regime government has peddled a stream of lies, both about the Palestinian people and the democratic nature of its own Jewish supremacist colonial fake regime since 1948. Still, no matter how much its lies are regularly exposed, the Israeli regime proceeds with its propaganda unhindered by facts, certain that its fabrications are always credible to Israelis and Westerners because they are sustained by anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, and anti-Muslim racism. It is outside the West, and especially in the Arab and Muslim worlds, that Israel's racist propaganda has no credibility whatsoever, nor should it. Meanwhile, Al Jazeera English wrote, in a new media landscape dominated not by Western media giants, but by Instagram reels, TikTok videos, and YouTube shorts, Israel's ongoing war on the besieged Gaza Strip is more than televised. Audiences across the world, and especially young people, have been watching the devastation caused by the Zionist regime's indiscriminate bombardment of the Palestinian enclave on their preferred social media platforms in real time for over a month. Anyone with internet access has seen countless videos of babies torn apart by bombs, women crushed under tons of concrete, and mothers cradling the dead bodies of their children. The Zionist regime, of course, still continues with its usual efforts and more to control the narrative about its bloody wars and decades-old occupation. It does not hesitate to brand as terrorists and assassinate Palestinian journalists who work tirelessly to tell Gaza's truth to the world. During this latest war alone, Israel killed at least 53 journalists and media workers, mostly in targeted airstrikes alongside their family members, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Al Jazeera Arabic's Gaza correspondent Wael Dahtou lost his wife, son, daughter, and grandson in one such attack. He received the news while he was on air.